Shoes. Recorded live.
Welcome to another week of 42 Minutes. This is Doug, and Will is on the line also, and we're going to continue our discussion about synchronicity that we bumped into this week. Lots of ums there. I'm going to let Will start off and talk about the Tiferet, or the, I don't know how to say that.
I know what you're talking about. Oh, yeah. Actually, let's see. How did this get started? Well, we were talking about V for Vendetta last week.
Well, so did you decide or allude to the idea that Natalie Portman is the Tiferet? Is that
it's not that she's the Tiferet. Okay, this is how it works. Well, we were talking about Beauty and the Beast, right? And the Beauty and the Beast theme has a lot to do with the specific tarot card called Strength in the deck, which lies, okay, so if you have the Kabbalah Tree of Life, and what the Kabbalah Tree of Life is sort of like a filing cabinet for archetypes, right? And so stories resonate with the certain sephiroths or spheres in the tree at the same time. Now, Natalie Portman, she actually is kind of like Malkuth. She's a mother, so she gives birth to these archetypical like savior babies over and over again, and so she resonates with the Christ, too. And what the Tiferet is, or the Tiferet, which is the, I'm not sure which number it is. Let's see. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it would probably be 6. Yes, the 6th Tiferet. It's like the Christ. It's the middle of the tree, and it hooks to all the other Tiferet. If you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it is like where the heart, it's associated with the sun and it's associated with Christ. And you can see the relationship to it and Christ, because if a picture of Christ will have a light emanating from its heart, and one side will be red and one side will be blue. And those colors correspond to the left and the right side of the tree of life as well. So there's automatically some relationship to that, that's acknowledged between religion and whatnot. But anyways, the Tiferet has a path that goes directly to Kether. It goes directly up from Tiferet to Kether, which is the crown, and through the hidden Sephiroth or sphere called Dath, which relates to Darth Vader. So it's mm-hmm. the Abyss. That card, the tarot card that rolls right through the middle of that, is a strength card, or the one where beauty is controlling the beast. And that's why that thread, one of the like most important threads in all of the Kabbalah, is associated to that Beauty and the Beast card, and that's why Crowley used it, and that it has to do with so many symbolisms and my work and in others where that 93 has to do with the crumbling of the towers and why Beauty and the Beast keeps interlocking. And with the Twin Towers, it's because all of those themes are related. That's why Natalie Portman, it also has a lot to do with robots and the Tin Man Theorem. See, Natalie Portman hooks in with Darth Vader, right, who is like the Dark Man, exactly like the V for Vendetta, as I think it was, Jason sent us that email about right after we talked about it. Beautiful work. I mean, he's got V for Vendetta with Natalie Portman standing in front of V, and then the Black Swan poster where the Black Swan is covering her up. With the same Man in Black, Beauty and the Beast theorem that relates back over into Darth Vader as well. I mean, it's a fantastic interplay of her character. And are you following me at all? I mean, I've been kind of taking
no,
the
No, I'm
run.
Following you. This is a lesson in the tree of life. So that's the question that I have. So I have been really reluctant to explore the Kabbalistic system. I have Manly P.
Yeah.
Hall on my bedside, but I haven't really sat down and read that one yet. Where did you learn about the Sephira and the meanings of the Sephira?
It just kept happening over and over. It took me a while to understand exactly what it was, and I really, truly would not be pretentious enough to say that I know what it is. But, I mean, when you read about who it has influenced, when Siegfried Roy, or what's his fucking name? I keep saying his name wrong.
Siegfried Roy.
I always, since I was a kid, said his name wrong. Anyway, that dude, it was found in his library when he died. Of course, Jung probably explained it the best to me. But then I found out a little bit about how Crowley and, like, Libra 777 is basically, like, he just takes the Sephira and he labels them with archetypes.
Uh-huh. Well, so here's an interesting story.
It relates a great deal to storytelling. I think that it's almost like it's programming for your head. It's like how your head is programmed is how you can look at it. Now, there's different ways of using it because you can reprogram yourself. And that's why they're associated with magic, because how magic happens is the manipulation of reality. And the only way you can really manipulate reality is with thought, because all reality is thought. So manipulating thought manipulates reality. And that's why hallucinogenic drugs are like a way for modern man to quickly manipulate reality. You get what I'm saying?
Andres Jones?
Too far. Have I gone too far with it?
No, you're perfect. In Olympia, Washington, there is a tree of life kind of built into the city. And I don't know if it's partially intentional or not intentional at all, but so his routine or practice, you know, what keeps him in balance is that he actually physically runs the Tree of Life, because I wasn't able to go and see it. But to not know the archetypes associated with each of the Sephira, it doesn't have any meaning for me, so I'm going to have to.
Right. But, well, there's a couple of basics that are easy to understand. The first top, or the three, 1, 2, 3, at the very top are what could, like Jung labeled them. See, people have read this and interpreted it, and their interpretations help us figure out what's going on. But, you know, like, you have to, I think it's like a modern way of reinterpreting it, so you can throw away all the old traditions and know what it is telling you now. The three top ones, Jung called intuition, which was Kephir, the crown, and then, what is it, Chokmah and Binah, are the two top ones. And Chokmah, which is on the right side, is associated with male aspect. Binah is associated with female aspect. So, just real basic, the top is Kephir, which is beyond sex. The two next ones are on each side of it and pretty much lay down the foundation of the opposites of male and female.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird because the male has female aspects because it's basically like Jupiter. I'm not saying that it's Jupiter. I'm not attaching it wholeheartedly to Jupiter. I'm just saying that's an easy way to categorize it.
Mm-hmm.
Jupiter is like this beneficial aspect. And then the other one, Binah, is like Mars, who is all war and judgment and discipline. But the war side is the feminine side, and the male side is the mothery side. It's messed up. And then those interplay through the middle path that goes directly down to Malkuth, which is at the bottom by itself. It only touches one other one, which is associated to the moon. See, it's interesting, because you sent me this stuff about the solar cross and stuff.
Yes.
And the solar cross is nothing but a representation of the tree. All that the tree is the X. You get what I'm saying? It's the...
Well, so there's
the... It's the solar
cross. There's the
cross.
Chakra system.
And I could see how, so I've done a little bit of research on the seven chakras, which is Jacob's ladder, which probably is the tree of life. It's just,
yes.
Can, have you
well, it's a deep-rooted
related those?
Like technique for humans to understand concepts. The circle with the X is the mental, you can, so it's just a four separated into quadrants. And our psychology is the stars. But the thing is since we're not looking at the stars, our psychology is coming through in the movies now. Because it's got to come out. It's going to come out no matter what, because it's part of, like, who we are.
Okay, so that's an interesting segue. So we're not looking at the stars, but we are looking at our clocks, our watches. And somehow that has meaning in a world where everything is regulated by time.
Right.
See,
that solar cross, man. The solar cross is probably the oldest religious symbol in the world, appearing in Asia, American, European, and Indian religious art from the dawn of history.
Okay.
Now, a controlling symbol, a symbol that comes out of us no matter who we are. And it's the swastika. That's what's so fucked up. You know, that's what we were talking about the call the other day, and Alan being on the call to Red Ice, and they made that point of saying the swastika is not like the Nazi symbol.
But they own it.
All the swastika is the solar cross, it's the tree of life. All it is like that turning of the clock. That's it. It's gear work. That's fucked up. You know, I learned the other day, too, the Nazis were the first people, or the ones to, one of the biggest customers for IBM. Did you know that?
Yeah, but one of IBM's first big, I don't know, that was something, I don't know how true a lot of that stuff. I did quite a bit of research about.
It's the number system. All it was a punch card number system that IBM had at that time. And the
right,
numbers on which were a categorization. The numbers told you who they were, where they came from, and stuff.
Right.
So it's just a data
right.
entry.
Right. But what did they do with the punch card system? Why did they need all that?
I don't know. But they used it. Obviously, they had the numbers.
I think
they
it
were
was
dealing with millions of Jews. It was categorization. I don't know. It's fucked up. That's what it is. It's messed up.
Yeah.
Hey, there's you see, it's funny. I went and watched Cars 2 this weekend with my daughter, and I thought about you because I was watching it, and there's a point where they're in Big Ben. They're in a clock, and she's trying to get loose, and the guy mentions time, and she goes, "Oh, time!" And she's like, "I can turn time backwards," and she spits something out and reverses the flow of some the generator, and when the reverse of the flow of the generator happens, the gears roll backwards and she's able to get loose. But I immediately thought of you because your comments about time lately, consistent comments about time. I mean, what is time doing to you right now?
Well, so I'm reading that book. It's called About Time, and what it's doing is it's showing one of the results of kind of losing the night sky as far as moderns go, because it's a history of time, which is really interesting. The book is about how, as a society, culture, we developed our technologies and our relationship with the technologies, you know, kind of created the situation where we're at, where we relate to time, not through the sky anymore, not through the stars, I mean, a little bit with the sun and the moon, but more so with the you know, our machine that tells us what it is. And so we're relating to time with that. But the problem with that is that we're not connected to anything but the abstraction. So we're not connected to the season necessarily, or our specific place
Oh, so that's an interesting conspiracy theory. Before there was any standardization, you know, and this was around the time of the railroads and telegraph, every city set their own time, you know, and they could pick whatever they wanted. And so there was this move in because of the trains to have a one world time, you know. So you know how there's Greenwich Mean Time. It would be set up to the way our body understands time, with noon being the sun directly overhead. Well, if it's noon there, then it's noon everywhere. And so it doesn't matter where the sun is. You know, if you're 12 hours different, your noon would be midnight. And so I just thought that would be, there was a movement towards, this is before time zones. So they were going to have one world time.
Right. Which was a huge thing. I mean, that changed the world. That changed the, flipped the world on its head. I was listening to Neil Portman the other day. I think that's his name. Perlman? Neil Portman. I'm just now starting to get into him, but he made this whole comment about how different technologies through the world flipped the world on its end, like written word, or when time was produced into the 24, you know, time zone. But it's funny because, you know, right now we made the connection that time is money, and money is time right now. It is out there in full force. And the Vatican just the other day put out that they were advocating a one world monetary system, so a universal money. So they're trying to do the same with money as they did with time. And really all that will is a coin. I think the first Wheel of Fortune was, I mean, that's what money and time have so much to do with each other, just because the Wheel of Fortune has to do with
book. This book that I'm reading, the guy says the reason why money is time is because that's how we've organized our society. That in one of the, right around the time of Newton, there was a guy named Crowley, and he had an ironworks shop, and he realized how important production value was. And so he actually had someone called the Time Warden. The guy worked 24 hours a day, and it was his job to make sure that you were working when you were supposed to be working. But he called him a warden. And so it's just so interesting to me, because it's almost like PKD's Black Iron Prison is our clock, you know. We are...
Oh, nice.
We're slaves to the clock, where instead of, I know my body, once it starts getting fall, and then especially winter, it wants to sleep more. It doesn't want to get up super early and go and work just because the clock says, you know, you're supposed to work 8 hours a day, but the time warden says, no, you got to be here at 6 a.m., even though it's pitch black outside until, you know what I mean? That would be a more... And so that's, I guess, why I'm interested in this notion of the solar year, where our different points that we celebrate, the big points in the season are those things like the two equinoxes and the solstices. Those are the four big holidays of the year, and that's the cross, the solar cross. And then it's interesting that you would relate that to the Tree of Life also.
Well, I mean, it is the tree. The solar axis was used as a symbol for the axis, the tree that took you up to the axis of knowledge in American Indian mythology. It's the same aspect. It's also Odin's tree that he... Okay, we got a couple of different ways we can go with this real quick. Okay, we'll do it this way. It has a lot to do with man's evolution. We can see the representation of the tree being, you know, manipulated in Mario Brothers, and then the direct relationship of evolution right afterwards when they use the Devo gun. And then in the movie Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Caesar, the monkey, Julius Caesar, so that
here's a point, real fast. Do you know what Julius Caesar started as? I mean, so it's interesting. He was a master of time.
It's
the Julian calendar. So, I mean, how did he unify his power? He set the calendar for the entire empire.
Why? Now, in that movie, Julius Caesar the monkey has a window that he views the outside world, and it's a circle with a subversive S in it. It's a circle window that he looks out of the top room, and it has four intersecting, which is the cross. It's the solar cross. It's also Eden, because Eden was a territory in the Bible that had four converging rivers. Rivers, always a symbol of time. Always. So his window to the outside world is the X, the cross. And he uses that. He paints it on a wall, and when the monkeys are revolting or evolving, they're putting it on street signs and stuff. So the symbol with that circle X that translates over to movies like Meet Joe Young, when it climbs the Ferris wheel, which is just another representation, all has to do with monkey climbing that tree. And even at the end of the movie of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, they get to the garden. They cross the Golden Gate, and they get into this redwood area where they can redwood, that's interesting, where they can climb these trees and look out. It's the axis. That's what the Indians called the axis, or that circle was the way to get higher information. You'd climb the tree and you'd get to a point where you could see on different levels. And so all of this is representing, like, man, this is our evolution. Through time, we evolve through time. We evolve because of the wheel and because of the tree. It's fucked up, man. Now I can see all kinds of relationships in Jake and Jim's movie that they did the monkey video that were not intentional. Or maybe they were. I mean, some things I think weren't. But it's interesting because they play Vertigo in there, where they're talking about the redwood, and she's showing the rings of the tree. You know what I mean? She's showing how that relates to time.
Which is, whenever they show the rings of a tree at like a roadside stop, you end up creating a solar cross because you're going to have to put a vertical line through those concentric circles.
Very nice, very nice.
And shows, the ladder of time. Another interesting point with the axis or the cross is that Joseph Campbell used to make a big deal about how the point where they meet, you know, that point is the point where spirit and matter, time and eternity, become one. Where you are. It's Jesus on the cross, where he is. That's the central point where you know. But it's also interesting because we keep talking about the clock, and so that's the new symbol of, you know. So we've got Dr. Emmett Brown hanging off the clock in Back to the Future, you know, that, or Hugo Cabret. It seems like I've seen a poster with him hanging off the clock. So perhaps, you know, if we were going to create a new religion.
It's Christ hanging on the clock. Who said that the other day? They showed the Groundhog Day poster. And on the Groundhog Day poster, Bill Murray is in the center of a clock. Like, it shows the girl and it shows Bill Murray, like, trapped in a clock.
Okay, so we don't have to make up the religion. We've already, it's there. It's Bill Murray's Jesus, okay?
Well, Jesus is in the middle of the clock. He's the 13th, and the 12 disciples circle him.
Of course. Right.
So, that's why they put the rose. You know how the Rosicrucians would make a cross with Christ, or they'd put a rose in the center of the cross, because that rose, it symbolizes the soul. It's the soul pinned to time. I see. That's why the rose is so imprinted in the Beauty and the Beast symbolism, too, because it's the soul of the world. And that's why that freaking rose is in damn the Twin Towers too, and the roses and the wheel, because the towers at the center of the wheel. Holy shit!
I think another perspective would put the rose is Sophia is wisdom, like in a Gnostic tradition where. What's interesting in the story, a lot of the Beauty and the Beast, is the destruction of the rose, where it seems like Philip K. Dick has a lot of those stories where it's the dead girl, or Leonardo DiCaprio's got a lot of dead girls too, or the dead wife.
Yeah.
You know, and so we get stuck in this cycle of like it's a repeating time loop where somehow
K. Dick had to do with his sister because he was a twin, and his sister died at birth.
Interesting.
Both of them are buried up here, about an hour and a half. I know where the graveyard is, but I haven't had the time to go up here and wander around it until I found K. Dick. But yes, a lot of his stories have to do with the woman who is. It's the Lilith character. The dead wife is Lilith. It's part of the subconscious.
Right, right. But so Natalie Portman's composite character really conforms to that, too, in that Luke Skywalker's dead mother. And then in Black Swan, taking on the darkness.
I haven't seen Swan yet. I've had all this Natalie Portman stuff locked up in me for years, man. I've never made a video. I mean, I've done post, but fully gotten it out.
It's a sink that I keep reminding myself that what's really fascinating is the well-known Harry Potter. Everyone knows the Harry Potter theme. The ba dun da dun da dun da. It's the same music for. Oh man, I can't think. It's either not Stravinsky, but the music for the Black Swan, the original ballet, just exactly. And then all of a sudden, you start connecting Harry Potter, and Voldemort, and you said Lilith. Well, of course, Harry Potter's mother is Lily, right? And she's a dead girl.
Right. Yeah.
So,
here, check this out. Check this. Do you know what the word Caesar means?
No.
It means Harry.
Harry?
Yes.
Huh. Oh, and then Potter. Think of Philip K. Dick's God in the pot. Remember how he had a friend throw him a pot?
Pointing to symbolism. It's pointing to symbolism. That's messed up. That's good. I like that.
Yeah. But then, you know, I think, Jason Ellis has done a lot of work on that idea of, you know, the alchemist, where the potter deals in fire because he's going to fire the clay and create a world. That's why, you know, he's Harry Potter, and Harry refers to his virility or his, you know, like, there's the lesser mystery with the sexual aspect of the symbolism, but then also the greater mystery, which is, you know, this, I don't even know how you point to that, the notion of the deeper meaning behind the seemingly vulgar sexual meanings, I guess. I don't know.
Yes. I can understand what you're saying. Well, listen, to go back to Planet of the Apes, his name is Caesar, and he has a birthmark. He's born by Immaculate Conception. He's taken out of the jungle. Nobody knew his mom was pregnant. Then he's born. So he's Jesus because his name is Caesar, but his name is Harry because it means Harry. And so he has a birthmark, much like Harry does, on the top of his head. Harry's is a lightning bolt, which directly points to, like, Hercules and stuff like that. He's marked as being Zeus's kid. And the actor who plays in Rise of the Planet of the Apes as Caesar's keeper is the same kid who plays Draco Malfoy.
Oh, cool.
And the guy who plays Malfoy has a prod, a cattle prod, that he pokes the monkeys with. And he'll stick it to the cage and make all the cattle fly. It's a magic wand. It's a magic wand.
Why is he going to be so mean to Harry Potter? Go ahead.
He's Harry. Caesar is Harry. Both of them represent the same character.
Yeah.
Which basically is King Felix. It's Dick's King Felix. It's because you remember how Harry takes Felix, Lexi, and gets lucky and starts falling into sync?
Yeah. It's okay, so I was at the library the other day, and I just, sometimes I'll grab things just because they, I don't know, they're weird, strike me. And I grabbed a book called New World Monkeys, which is combining my theme and your theme, or the two themes. I've been really kind of obsessed with the idea of the New World, but there's a rhino on the back, and it says, men are beasts. Here's Duncan, then. 32 and cobbled together from what he was handed. Improved by bottled water and corporate slow pitch, a weekly exfoliating cleanser he stocks in the bathroom cabinet without shame. Strong thatch of hair still, blue eyes muffled. And so, you know, the meaning of life is probably in this book here. I'll have to look at it this week and tell you about it. But so this is getting at what we're talking about and what the About Time is getting at, where we're stuck in our clock, and to connect to reality, to truth, to, you know, synchronous time and the earth that we live on, we kind of need to break out of our men suits and feel, you know, the monkeys underneath.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
To break, we need to, you know, why are you wearing that silly man suit? You know, to kind of get out of all this artificiality, abstraction of time and production and material, which is kind of what our society is built on, you know, the service of material, the accumulation of things that have no meaning outside of the fact that, you know, we worship things, and then, you know, put our monkey suits on and run around the trees and put our feet in the dirt, I guess.
Grow down.
And then as far as, okay, so that's something that I could say. Perhaps, like Hamlet, we're kind of stuck between these two worlds where this is the plight of moderns, and it has always been, where we have this kind of schizophrenic, there's the artificial reality, and this is especially true now with virtual reality, and there's reality where we, you know, there's the world that we live in and the trees on our block and the sun and, you know, the crickets. You know, that's reality. But then there's also this reality that we carry around with us either on our smartphone or when we tap into virtual reality. And so there's this kind of split between how we share our time. And this was evident before Newton came along. Before Newton, there was the world on the earth and the heavens. And he actually united those. He united heaven and earth with his laws of motion. But then, like every great story, you know, paradise is lost because now, because of classical science and predictability, we're trapped between two worlds where we lost heaven because progress has blotted out the night sky with light. And our addiction to time and production has, you know, made it difficult to have any sort of relationship with the sun and the moon and the stars.
All right, I'm reading you. But I'm interested more on your ideas of predictability. Do you think that synchronicism, not synchronicity, synchronicity is a totally different ballgame in my point. Synchronicism has its own kinds of flair, or it's a different flair than just synchronicity. But do you think that synchronicism is an art, or do you think that synchronicism is a science? And by science, I mean that it carries a certain amount of predictability.
It's interesting how we moderns think of the two separately, right? Art is on one side and science is on the other. And they're both interfacing with reality in their own idiom. I like to think of sync as both, where it's like a scientific dance. But whereas Newton's classical physics wants a rigid behavior to have a predictable state, which means certainty, where are you a smoker? This is a black or white yes or no question, you know? And how would you define that? If you smoked one cigarette, does that make you a smoker? If you smoke on a regular basis, does that make you a smoker? Or do we look at how you spend your time? You're one cigarette at night, does that make you a smoker? Okay, so what I'm saying is that within a quantum view, and quantum actually deals with very small, whereas the laws of motion as developed by Newton deals with, you know, large macro items. And so the problem right now is that the split, this Hamlet schizophrenic crackup is between how very, very small particles behave in relation to very, very large things, such as planetary bodies. What I'm saying is that sync is kind of ascribing the same type of openness that you have to have in a quantum perspective to all of reality. And so it can predict, but you have to actually map it over a duration where a pattern eventually will arise if you're willing to watch. And that will tell you its general state. If you want to say, what are you right now, and do the black and white question, which is the classical, you know, it's true for that moment, but it's not the truth, where so sync is a science, but it's also an art, and it's the mapping, a general, you know, mapping of the archetypes or reality or the fabric of time and being.
You didn't answer shit.
What?
You didn't answer shit. But I don't blame you, because it's not easy. I mean, yeah.
What are you talking about?
There has to be predictability. This is what Goro Adachi says. I want to read Goro Adachi's. I want to know what Goro Adachi says about predictability with sync in his book, or in the sync book, excuse me.
Do you have a sync book yet, Will?
No, I do not.
You need to get a sync book. This is your homework this week. You need to get a sync book.
because then once I get a sync book, I'm going to roll out to Philip K. Dick's grave, and I'm going to take a picture with the thing.
Okay, so after we're done with the call, I'm going to tell you how you can get a really cheap sync book.
All right, well, at first, right now, tell us How much time we got left?
We have, about 3 minutes, 2 minutes or so. So we're going to have to start wrapping it up. But I will read Goro's piece this week, and we'll talk about it next week. We'll talk about...
That's a great idea.
If you don't know what we're talking about with the Sync book, go to Red Ice and listen to Alan's really great interview about Alan, the editor of the Sync book, with Henrik about the Sync book. And I think there's the chance that more Sync book authors are going to show up on Red Ice talking about their pieces and their work in regard to the Sync book.
In fact, it might be a good idea to send emails to Red Ice on who you would like to see on Red Ice about the Sync book. I think that's a good idea.
That's a proactive way to go about it. So if you wanted to have Will Morgan talk about his piece, which I haven't read and I need to read also, come to Sync
now
book.
Now other people can handle it. I know that C. Wilner kind of backed down from and let some other people step ahead of him. So I think that's cool about Steve. But I would really like to hear Steve Wilner on Red Ice again, man. I like Wilner a lot. I'd like to hear Jake. Jake hasn't been on Red Ice in years now. But other people, I would want to know what Goro Adachi has to say, too. And I'm kind of interested in what I want to see this fantastic tale about this last chapter, this big chapter with all these tarot cards and Obama and Cheney and the Twin Towers on tarot cards. I want to see that stuff.
Okay, so you need to get a Sync book. That last chapter is by Ellis, by the way. My neighbor, he lives 3 blocks from my house, and I met him on the sinkhole, even though we lived 3 blocks in space from one another. We met non-locally. But we are running out of time, according to our watch, which is how we see the world. It's our abstraction. And so our 42 minutes are up this week. And so it was a lot of fun, Will. I think we...
Always is. Thanks a lot, Doug.
We'll talk next week. Take care.
Bye-bye.